Hello, this is Ronnie Sage, and this is The Impact Exchange, a podcast where we showcase emerging trends relating to nonprofits and retail and the intersection being corporate social responsibility. Throughout this season, we'll interview leadership from nonprofits and brands, both big and small, to hear their perspective, insights, and recommendations.
I'm Phil Caulfield. In our first episode, we explore the way nonprofits communicate with changing generations. Now that millennials outnumber boomers, and the way in which these nonprofits reach supporters has become more complex, it is more important than ever to stay relevant. We will discuss new tactics, tips, tricks, as well as challenges with our very special guest, Dory McCorder, CEO of YWCA Metropolitan Chicago.
Welcome, Dory.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We are very excited to have you. Our first episode on the Impact Exchange. This is big for us to have such a prominent guest join us today.
Well, thank you. I'm very excited.
Yes. So we look forward to hearing your story. We have an interesting topic here today. As Phil mentioned, you know, generations are changing. Millennials are now one of the largest population. We want to hear, you know, how your organization has changed through the decades since you've been with YWCA. We want to know your story and kind of how you're moving through it. So, love to start it off. Tell us about YWCA Metro Chicago. What's the history? How long have you been there? Give us the 30,000-foot scoop.
Sure. So the YWCA Metropolitan Chicago has been around for 140 years. So we're not talking about decades. We're talking about centuries, right? And changing over that time. So fortunately, though, I've had the pleasure of being the CEO at the YWCA for 5 years now. And prior to that, I actually sat on the board for 8 years. And so it's been 13 years in total. I say it's longer than I've been married, but I'm equally committed to both, so we're good. Yes, but I think that our mission has absolutely stayed the same. Broadly, it's eliminate racism and empower women. But I think that as we begin to, as you've mentioned, really figure out what does that look like, we've gotten deeper into what really we need to do, given that we are dealing with actually many generations in the marketplace, but also understanding how we can just be of the best service and create the greatest impact.
Very cool. So give us an example of what that impact looked like last year for women in Chicago.
Sure. So we serve over 200,000 women and families across the Chicago metropolitan area. So that's Cook County as well as DuPage and the surrounding counties. And we've really focused on what we consider three empowerment priorities. So we actually are the rape crisis lines for the metropolitan area, as well as we do a lot in the early childhood education space, including a lot in youth STEM. And we do economic empowerment services, which for us includes financial empowerment as well as career services. And we operate a small business development center on the south side of Chicago. So we're busy.
It sounds like it. So there's three main areas there you mentioned. Help us have the dollars make sense for our listeners. You know, what does $1 equal, or how much, you know, what is what equal in terms of impact for you?
Sure. Well, the first one that comes to mind is that I think about our tech girls and the work that we're trying to do. So a STEM toolkit for us will cost $10. And so, but we have hundreds of kids. So that's thousands of dollars we need relative to those STEM toolkits, and really helping expose children to the technology and the math skills that they need today. So that's one example. Our counseling services, as you could imagine, are more expensive. So we're talking about $100 would provide an hour of counseling services for someone who needs them as well. And the good thing about that is that we absolutely have the best counselors in the business, as far as I'm concerned, clinically, you know, qualified, credentialed social workers.
Unbelievable work that you're doing. Obviously, with the current climate of politics, which I don't want to get too deep into today, you guys have been busy. And I saw some recent articles, which is incredible. You guys are stepping up to the plate. And I should rather say you ladies are stepping up to the plate and coming through strong on this. So thank you from our community. But talk to me a little bit about that. You know, how have you seen this increase? You know, what has really surfaced in the last
Sure. Well, as we talk about, we're 140 years old. And so when you think about the core work that we're doing, it hasn't gone away. I think now the times have really emphasized that our work is even more critical than ever. And so particularly one of the metrics that we're using that we're seeing today is in our sexual violence support services. Because we operate the rape crisis line, we already see a 30% increase over last year, which these are significant numbers for us. And so the good thing is that we absolutely are happy that people are seeking help. But at the same time, it just continues to be a reminder that we still have so much to do. As long as we've been here, we know that we need to be here for as long as our work is needed.
Yes, absolutely. And in order to do that work, this brings us back to our topic of fundraising. Everything that you do as an organization comes through your supporters, your constituents, and the grants and the corporate giving. And we want to talk about how that's changed and what difference you're seeing. Want to go back to a quote you recently said in an article that nonprofit is a tax status, not a business model. I love that. Tell us what it means.
Well, for me, as an accountant, it really does mean what it says. Mm-hmm. It means that I need us to recognize that nonprofit, while it is absolutely a tax status, it has unfortunately been a euphemism for how people do business or lack thereof in the social services space, right, quite honestly. And so for me, I just say that all the time to remind people that we are in the same marketplace that every other business exists. Unfortunately, there's not a marketplace that exists with puppy dogs and butterflies for nonprofits. We have to compete for talent. We have to compete for resources along with other organizations. When we talk about, particularly, I know we'll get into this a little later, but when we think about millennials or other interests that people have, we have to compete for mind share just as much as any other business does.
Yeah. And share of wallet.
And absolutely share of wallet, which I love that you say that, because when I said that in our first staff meeting, people were not understanding what I was talking
absolutely
about. But it really is thinking about how do we engage people where they are today, leveraging all the different means that we have to do that, versus just thinking, we're a nonprofit, therefore we can only have government contracts and contributions contributions from people, and that's it.
Yes. Yes. Love that. Thank you for explaining. So talk to us about how have you seen fundraising efforts really change over your last 5 years, from where you started. What has that evolution been in the way you communicate and how where and how you're communicating with your audience?
Well, the most important thing to us is that we've actually don't use the word fundraising as much anymore. We talk about revenue generation.
Great.
And the reality of it is to remind people that it's still revenue.
Yeah.
And that, and actually the word revenue as well, there, to me, there's a connotation of there is some type of value being exchanged. And I want to always remind people that our services are absolutely valuable. The work that we do every day in the community is valuable. Nothing is free.
That's
Thank
right.
you. Nothing is free. And so for us, as we talk about the evolution of fundraising, we do start talking about what the different revenue generation strategies are, because I think that that also opens up our thought process around where do we look for resources and how we do create value that allow us to connect to get greater resources.
Very interesting. So where is that tactic changing? What is that message from, where did it start? What were you saying initially? And what does an actual conversation look like today with the millennial audience?
Well, for us, this notion of cause marketing is really a big deal. And because when you think about, I mentioned that we serve over 200,000 women and families, so we're communicating with a lot of different people. And so what we're very mindful is that these people that are working with us from a service perspective are also consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're also participating in the marketplace. And we, from a larger share of wallet perspective, have to think about how we can engage with them as well as attract resources based on the different types of engagements we can have.
Diversify.
Basic business concepts,
yes.
Ronnie. Exactly. And that's what we continue to tell people.
So I want to take a little tangent here. When you're thinking through a business model conversation, typically we look at it as ROI. How do you measure return? How do you measure ROI on every dollar generated? What does that equal? And how do you measure your team?
Well, there's interesting. So I tend to be very practical to some degree. So I will look at the bottom line. I say that there is only one goal, and the goal is for us to measure our ability to, for us, break even. But at the end of the day, I'm looking at revenue growth. And so since I've been there over the last 5 years, we have doubled. And so that to me is the biggest KPI that I see, but then also the reduction in our turnover rate because we're engaging people differently. So it's, so we have sort of big metrics like people, like revenue, as well as impact.
Great. And you're looking at people from both a constituent supporter base and employee base.
Absolutely. And specifically there, I was talking about more of our employee base because that is such a key factor. We're a human capital intensive
Absolutely.
Business. So that's all we have. We have
Yep.
people and spaces to do that, to do the work in, and that's it.
So you have all the same challenges of a normal corporation.
Absolutely.
Except where your revenue comes from. And that is bringing us back to what we're talking about today. So thinking about the way the communication is changing and in really the nonprofit sector and how that intersects really with the customer at the point of engagement. I recently saw a quote. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Michael J. Rossin. He's an author. He wrote a book called Engagement Fundamentals. And he stated that more than 99% of every donor time and energy is spent with themselves and your organization is done without you. You must accept this as the new reality, enabling your supporter to self-educate and self-navigate the decision-making process. What kind of resources are you providing them? How are you enabling them to self-educate when you're not there?
That's such a great question, because I continue to remind our team members that people are engaging with us different. First of all, we're not open 24 hours a day, but yet we know there's a 24/7 world out there. And so it's important for us to ensure that we have the appropriate social outreach, as well as we've recently launched an app that we're continuing to expand called Empower, which is our community engagement app, so that people can self-select which communities they want to be a part of relative to the content that we're providing on the app. And so absolutely, we need to make sure that our website, that every digital touch point we have is available, which is why, quite honestly, what your platform offers with Shopping gives us another engagement opportunity for constituents as well.
Well, I appreciate the shameless plug.
Yes, no, that's shameless for me, because it is actually part of our digital strategy. So, well, thank you.
Of course.
So, yeah, I want to jump in with millennials. Millennials specifically, it seems like 10 years ago, millennials got a really bad rap. They were known as the generation of being selfish, of getting things handed to them. And now there's a lot of reporting coming out saying that millennials are the biggest group of givers right now. They're not giving the most dollars because they're struggling still to get jobs. They're in debt with school. But how have you seen millennials in this environment giving to your organization?
Millennials have been interesting to me, and I hate to, you know, particularly given the work that we do, I hate to broadly categorize people, but I would say that millennials, my observation is at least have been that they lead more integrated lives. And so, well, I think their other generational counterparts tend to compartmentalize more. So they are the ones saying, I'm working, and now I will give philanthropically, whether it's my time or my
That's
dollar resources. My observation has been, they actually, Aaron Hirst, the founder of Taproot Foundation and the author of The Purpose Economy, talks about this, that previous generations are, they had a very linear giving sort of way, that it was learn, earn, return.
Right.
And millennials are doing all of that at the same time.
So they would allocate part of their wallet.
Absolutely.
They would know what they're going to give at the end of the year. They would account for that in their tax return. That's all changed.
Absolutely. People are looking to have all of those experiences at the same time, and not necessarily waiting till they're at the end of their career, or even understand that it only has to be in a form of a monetary gift.
Right.
They're looking for the knowledge exchange. They're looking for good experiences themselves. And I think that that's where we are. We have an opportunity to look at how we engage with the group that cares to participate like that.
Yeah, I think that's key. Being able to ask for more than just money. You know, there's a lot of things showing that this millennial group is very, very big on volunteering and things. So I'm sure you're getting a lot of those volunteers within your organization to make a difference. What types of content are you creating that you see really engages this audience?
Well, a couple things. One thing that we do, so we see from a content perspective, I would say that what we're doing is engaging through our different advisory councils. And so that's been really important to us. So some of the councils that we have created are focused on the specific work that we do. So it creates a what we consider a leadership volunteer opportunity. So we do have people that do volunteer work that's really hands-on and participating in our programs, but also doing volunteer work that's hands-on participating from a thought leadership perspective. For example, we launched an Impact Investing Advisory Council,
yes,
and we've included millennials on that council, and they are the best people to tap for knowledge and insight, and they jump on projects like you would not believe. So we have absolutely been tapping into more of that intellect, quite honestly.
That's interesting, especially as you look at the diversity in the room when you're talking about fund allocation and advisory fund. You recently launched an ETF. Wild concept. For those of you who understand indexes and finance, this is the idea of taking I'm going to let you describe it rather than me trying to botch this.
Sure. So speaking of acronyms, so an exchange-traded fund, so essentially it's a basket of stocks that are selected by our registered investment advisor, who happens to also be a nonprofit, that have used criteria to compile the stocks that are most empowering to women based on social screens that we've also approved.
Sure. So how does the general person out there get involved and invest into an ETF like this one?
So contact their broker. It's actually available across a lot of different brokerage platforms right now. So Schwab or whoever you may use for that. And we're excited to see there's so many types of opportunities that people can look at how they can get involved in the investing market as well.
That's great. So this is another way to diversify your investment portfolio that is impactful, really.
Absolutely. And the benefit of this, too, talking about revenue streams for us, is that we get a portion of the advisory fees come back to us as well.
And that's how you make money.
That's how we make money on that opportunity.
Great. That's very interesting. So, Dory, looking at social media, understanding that millennials are on their phones more than 50 times a day, that's three times the rate of boomers. You have to be in their palm of their hands in order to reach them. How are you using social media to reach these different audiences? Are you expanding into the realm of Snapchat? Are you talking on Instagram? How are you being relevant in terms of social media with the organization?
The good thing is that I have a small but mighty team that's really focused on the different social media channels. So yes, we have Snapchat. Yes, we're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and just continue to be mindful of what we do to engage across those different platforms so that we have a content strategy. So I think that from the time when I first started with the YWCA, I think I had more Twitter followers than the organization did. But we've really upped our game. So that has really helped us. And by focusing on it, so that's really helped us increase our followers, but also increase our relevancy as we are having the different conversations across the different platforms.
So how do you tell that story and tell such a compelling and important message in under 280 characters?
I think we have to be very clear what that message is and that's why I think the different strategies matter. So when we're talking about our shopping platforms, then we know which platform to use to make sure that we are communicating what we need to very concisely. So I think we can't talk about complex policy issues a lot within 280 characters, right? And so we are just mindful, I think, of what the platforms lend themselves relative to content. And even one of the things I've been proud about, the team has really used LinkedIn even more to convey different messages depending on, again, the content.
That's interesting. So looking at the different types of strategies in your revenue line, are you aligning those at all to the different medians?
Yeah, we are. We're looking at, for example, when we're talking about different revenue strategies or we're talking about different partnership strategies, we're very mindful about how we can implement those strategies or execute those strategies or expand those strategies to a digital platform. And sometimes it lends itself to social, but what we're also doing is looking for our partners that could also leverage their digital platforms to support our cause as well.
Can you give me an example of that?
One example for us was Uber. So they use, during Women's Equality Day, they use their Uber account to talk about us. So they have way more reach than we do. And so it's those types of opportunities that we want to be very thoughtful of. So it's not necessarily, so same mediums, but different, the accounts matter, right?
Thinking about tips and tricks and actionable ideas that other nonprofits could use. You have, compared to a lot of nonprofits, a lot of resources, I would say. Still might not feel like enough ever. It's never enough.
As long as we're eliminating racism and empowering women, it's hard to figure out what's the right amount.
And that's always the challenge.
Sure. You know,
as we think about from big to small, no matter what the size is of these organizations, could you give me three tools that are currently in your team's repertoire that they, you know, pull out of the toolbox to manage, you know, whether it be your CRM or your social or your fund management? What are three tools in your toolbox?
That's such a good question because I think it just varies so much. I think that I think about the broad tools like cause marketing, like strategic partnerships, like what we're doing across our social channels and what we're doing purely from marketing as well. Mm-hmm. So I think of broad-based strategies. And not necessarily always an explicit tool, but know that the tools that we do use are very much aligned to what those strategies are. Because even when you think about cause marketing, There's a way, I think, to do it very well and a way not to do it very well.
Tell me what that means.
So, for example, we're not passive cause marketers. So that doesn't mean you throw our little logo on something and good luck to you. We hope that your product sells. We're actively engaging with whatever product or organization mm-hmm. that is and saying, this is why we're partnering with them. This is why it's important that you support them. So we consider ourselves very active from that respect and then show that alignment. Like, we're not doing random things either right. just because someone's going to support us. We really need to be aligned on values, aligned on how we think that we can create impact with that particular opportunity.
As you've seen success in the past, I know you've done some really interesting activations. Can you talk to us about some of those cause marketing activations that have been successful for you historically?
Sure. One of the great things that we've done is that we partnered very early on. Actually, when I first got to the YWCA, people accused me of just having shopping parties. And mm-hmm. I was like, what are you talking about? The good thing is that those type of cause marketing events actually helped us get through the budget impasse when other organizations were failing. So I take that any day. But one of our most successful ones had been with Tamara Mellon, who was the founder of Jimmy Choo,
wow.
the designer, mm-hmm. of course, most people know who Jimmy Choo is. But initially, when we started that partnership with Nordstrom's and Jimmy Choo, that it was a singular most successful event that they had for a single brand in the Nordstrom's
wow.
Family of brands that they carry. So much so that we actually formed a separate relationship with the founder, Tamara Mellon. So when she left Jimmy Choo, we actually now host trunk shows for her.
That's amazing.
And so people don't think about how important that is. But what's amazing, she's a woman entrepreneur as well. So she really lives our mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so that to me is what we can do with the power of cause marketing and really collaborating with brands and with people who share our beliefs.
I love it. So stemming off of that, you have something called Why Shop. Tell us about Why Shop. I mean, from the innovation of everything that you do, from an application to Why Shop to an ETF fund, you're across the entire spectrum here. I can only imagine what your revenue streams look like, how many different items are in that portfolio of how you make.
Sure, the accountants love us.
Yeah, I could only assume.
So with Why Shop, the way it goes back to actually one of your earlier questions, Ronnie, the way the Why Shop came up is that we had a grant opportunity that wanted us to identify different revenue streams that were not part of traditional fundraising models. So essentially, increased share of wallet. And so as we took a look at that, we were thinking, well, what do we have that could absolutely contribute to that and give us a diversification of revenue, but also be meaningful to us in the work that we're trying to do? And so we wanted greater digital engagement with our constituents as well. So we determined that the Why Shop, which is our e-boutique, we like to call it, we actually like to call it as well as the Amazon of cause marketing, but Amazon's so not scared of us yet, but because it allows us to create to have a platform where we could support merchants. And right now, those merchants happen to be women and people of color more so than not on the platform.
Sure.
So we were able to provide them another channel. But because we were able to do this, it gave us a way to engage with our constituents, provide another service to small business owners, as well as connect with our or create more revenue a little differently. So it really fulfilled a number of areas for us as well.
As you look at your customer and how they weave through your relationship with them as a customer and a supporter, how are you tracking, you know, that passive giving of Why Shop? And do you see them, you know, somebody who might not give normally and cut you that yearly check, but you see that little uptick in them actually coming and shopping through Why Shop or coming and downloading the application? Are you weaving those relationships together, and do you, you know, how do you use that data?
So two things. First thing, no. What we've learned is that it's hard for us with our current systems to track who's coming in for service versus who's participating on Why Shop. So we haven't gotten that sophisticated yet. So that's why Amazon is not worried about us, first of all. Second of all, what happens though is that we find that the folks participating on Why Shop, for example, we had a Why Shop sponsored cause marketing event in store. people were literally saying, oh, I just gave the YWCA $500, but in that case, they actually bought $5,000 worth of stuff. They wouldn't have just written us a $500 check, which is so fascinating to me. So what we have an opportunity to do with a platform like Y-Shop is to engage people that in their sort of natural habitat of shopping or being consumers versus being donors, because they don't necessarily connect that they could just write us a $500 check. It doesn't necessarily have the same gratification of buying beautiful shoes or purses or whatever the case may be. And then, by the way, also giving us a portion of that.
And that's something that we absolutely see. So another shameless plug in our product of, it's called Change Commerce. So we recently launched a product that enables all retailers to get back directly from their shopping cart. So without the user having to go to a platform like our marketplace shopping gives, this enables these brands to have that giving moment and that passive giving. And it's exactly what you just said, is that it's capturing the customer in their natural process, and it's that passive mechanism. And my question is going to be a little self-deprecating potentially, but how do you see the increase or decrease in giving or that lifetime value of a individual constituent or supporter go up or down based on, because they feel like they've engaged with you at that moment, that serotonin or dopamine. Serotonin means they would be falling asleep.
Right. That dopamine, we probably do that too to some people.
Melatonin. So.
there it is. What's the serotonin?
I don't remember.
No, Dory? Okay. We don't know what serotonin. But in any case, the dopamine hit comes in when they have that purchase. It's that, what drives them to potentially convert sometimes. And that's part of our thesis in this product, is that this helps at that conversion moment. How does that relate to your overall giving? Because if the customer feels like they're giving at that moment, they now are engaged with you. They've built a relationship with you, potentially passively, but it's still that relationship that we believe is important. And it's connecting you to that brand at that moment.
Absolutely. And I think what we have to keep in mind is that people, particularly women, are not monolithic. And so we want to make sure that we have strategies to engage people how they want to be engaged. So exactly. Some people, regardless of if we can name what chemical reaction happens during each process, we have some people that absolutely feel really good about writing us a check. But we absolutely have some people that just knowing that they supported us through a particular purchase feel amazing. We don't think either good gift is better or worse than the other.
And you'd rather have that relationship.
And I'd rather have that interaction. But what we were doing before, we were missing out on that whole opportunity on the consumer side because we didn't have anything to offer them. And that, to me, is the largest share of wallet conversation. Because even if they did write or give us a philanthropic gift and write a check or however they chose to do it, we weren't necessarily even giving them the opportunity to engage from a consumer perspective as well. And to me, I hate those conversations, quite honestly, where people send notes. So, forgive me if I'm about to offend people that say, you can forego that one pair of shoes and donate that to the YWCA. No, buy the shoes. Yep. However, buy the shoes from somebody that's also going to give us money, right?
Yes.
And so that's what we want people to do. We don't want this sort of, false trade-off anyway around how people can give to us by giving up something they love to do. We think we can do both.
Buy those shoes from a women-owned brand.
Absolutely. And you're helping our mission too, right?
So, exactly.
Absolutely.
We call that the same pair of pants, different pockets.
Yes.
So just a matter of, where that dollar is coming from, but still the same wallet.
Absolutely.
So as we close out this episode today of the changing economy and giving, talk to us about any what you think the future is. What do you think lies ahead in terms of nonprofit, corporate social responsibility? Where do you see the next 6 months to 6 years going in the sector?
I think that over the next 6 months, I think we're going to see a continued trajectory of this integration that we talked about, that people aren't that compartmentalized. We're still all vying for mind share and being able to communicate to people. And I think you're going to see more collaborations to accommodate that. I see it on for-profit businesses all the time, sort of unique partnerships that you wouldn't have necessarily expected because people are trying to maximize a single moment. I see the same thing has to happen from a giving perspective, and just how and what people care about. And particularly as you talk about impact, there's so many ways to create impact, whether it's to do direct service like we do every day, but also who and how you buy and what you do when you spend your dollars. So I just think these whole all of these conversations, quite honestly, are going to continue to merge, and that we're just going to have to find better opportunities to engage people how they want to be engaged within those conversations.
Right time, right place.
You absolutely.
Know, that whole marketing conversation comes, you know, it, as it shifts from the for-profit side, it's going back to what you started with, that nonprofit is not a tax status. It is a tax status. It is not a business model.
Absolutely.
So again, nonprofit is a tax status, not a business model. And that relates across the entire board, whether it be from your marketing, your employee management, your communications with what are your customers or supporters. It rounds out that it's really the way you approach it needs to be treated as a business at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
And as the customers evolved, you need to stay current.
Perfect.
Awesome. Well, Dori, thank you so much for joining us today on the Impact Exchange. It was an honor, and we are humbled to have you on our first episode. We would love to have you back here in the future.
Happy to. Thank you all for having me.
Thank you so much.
This is Ronnie Sage, and thank you for joining us on the Impact Exchange. This episode was brought to you by White & Warren. For over 20 years, this woman-led organization has pushed the boundaries of approachability and luxury knits, starting with iconic travel wraps focused on doing good in the communities they serve. WhiteandWarren.com.